Good morning. I'm your host, Claudia Shamba, welcoming you to the August 18, 2015 edition of Ask a Leader. We're talking healthcare today. Last month, Medicare celebrated its 50th anniversary, looking back on this achievement as well as forward towards some new developments aimed at improving medical care in this country is David Sine, Medicare and Medicaid Regional Administrator for the Western U.S. Then in the second segment, we'll hear from the co-founders of Professional Alliance for Financial Professionals, providing legal and financial advice to families caring for children with urgent needs, and that will be Jim Dell and John Byer. Well, welcome back. Last month, Medicare celebrated its 50th anniversary with over 55 million served, even better, Medicaid serving 70 million, 5.6 million of Medicare beneficiaries and 12.2 million beneficiaries of Medicaid are Californian. With us to look back on this achievement and look forward is my first guest, David Sine, Region 9 Director based in San Francisco. His jurisdiction includes California, Arizona, Nevada, Hawaii, and the Pacific Territories. That's probably, well, he probably gets too many jokes about his having to go travel at work. So today, David's civil service portfolio includes more than 20, actually, you're probably beyond the 32 years of experience in health and human services program. His work includes Medicare health plans operations, leading all private health plan contract operations for Medicare Advantage and the Medicare prescription drug benefit in Region 9. He ran the Medicare Contractor Financial Management Program and Integrity Functions. He earned his bachelor's degree in philosophy from Temple University in Philadelphia and an MBA with an emphasis on health administration from Temple as well. He comes to us today from San Francisco. Welcome back to Ask a Leader, David Sine.
Great to be here.
So congratulations to the federally funded Medicare program, 50 years young. I like that your agency is soliciting stories about how the program has changed their lives. It is what it's meant to them. Many testimonials are available on the MedicareAdvocacy.org website, as well as maybe even on the Medicare website. It's really worth the read. Well, some could argue that Medicare is one proof, another form of proof there is civilization in the United States. So, David, take us back to the years just before Medicare and Medicaid were signed into law in 1965. What was the U.S. healthcare system like then?
Well, it was really quite different, and the healthcare risk that people faced was a hospitalization. So when people became very ill in those days, we didn't have all the life-saving treatments we had today. They went to the hospital, they stayed there for a pretty long time, and they passed. One doctor friend of mine that I did a program with said that sometimes people would put grandma in the hospital so they could go on vacation. The hospital wasn't that expensive, but it would add up. And at that time, half of the people over 65 had no health insurance at all. And now we're down at 2% for people over 65. So that risk of financial peril is passed for those people, and that's important. And the other thing that's important is, you know, the life expectancy for a person at age 65, in other words, their horizon for the rest, is 5 years longer for the person that's turned 65 today versus someone in 1965. And a lot of that has to do with advances in medical science, but a lot of those advances in medical science that targeted chronic diseases in older people were partially fueled by the fact that Medicare reimbursement was available to treat those problems.
So when you talked about the stress of not getting, having that health care net to catch Americans, that, I mean, now with that stress relieved, that is a health care benefit right there, as well as you said, it's quality and equality, longevity with that kind of stress, that burden removed to some extent with that kind of health care safety net.
That's correct, and I think that that's exactly what Congress and President Johnson intended to do at the time, and I think they were successful in that regard.
And so it's sort of, we saw this with the adoption of the Affordable Care Act, that Medicare, there was a lot of bickering during the early promulgation of that program, but it grew on America. Everybody liked it. They liked it so much they forgot it was a federal program when they were talking about how little federal government they wanted in their lives. But it took a little time, but I don't know if you can plot those dots where it became something that people actually understood and it became a universally accepted program.
Well, one thing is that these things obviously take time, and there was a concern in the medical community that physicians would face a situation where the governments would begin to control their work. And if we think about the professions, accounting, law, medicine, the reason they're called professionals is because they police themselves. There's a medical board of physicians that handles licensing physicians or if there's a problem with the physician's performance, and that's as it should be. And so Medicare looked like a threat to that. And the Congress was able to construct a program that really did not turn out to do that. So our program doesn't tell doctors what they can and can't do. Our program tells our beneficiaries what they have insurance coverage for. So my wife has a crack in her windshield. I called Allstate. They sent a guy out here to put some glue on it or something, because that's what they'll pay for. If I want a new windshield, it's going to cost me $100. And that's how insurance works. But here's the thing, or a thing that I think is really quite important about Medicare. For people that are on Medicare today, they're receiving a significant financial benefit. If we look at the percentage of lifetime earnings that they have invested in Medicare, it's 2% of all the money they earned. That's your Medicare tax. That's the part of your FICA tax that goes to Medicare. 2% lifetime investment, and the average Medicare beneficiary harvests 11% of their lifetime earnings, that many dollars,
wow,
in Medicare benefits over the course of their life while they're in Medicare.
Nice
so
return.
Any investment where I can put down $2 and get $11 back, make $9 every time, that's going to become a popular investment. So that's what's happened. As healthcare has become much more expensive in the recent past, and people paid their premiums in long ago when salaries were lower, the program has become more expensive. And we've had to do things and find ways to resolve that, and that's been done a number of times, and I'm sure in the future it will continue to be done.
And we can get to some of those solvency questions in just a little bit, but do you think that the Medicare program was a factor in how the Affordable Care Act, that was trying to expand coverage to more Americans, do you think the Medicare program helped sell the Affordable Care Act?
Well, two things about that. One is there's a strong contingent of people that advocate this Medicare for everyone idea. So the fact that there exists this single-payer health care program, which is the largest single-payer health care program on the planet, both in terms of dollars and in terms of the beneficiaries it cares for, people see this model of a health care program that they think would be great for everybody. They're not looking at how much that would cost, although, of course, younger folks aren't as expensive to care for. Nonetheless, we're not collecting taxes for those people now. That's, an important factor to think about. And the other thing is there's a whole lot of the Affordable Care Act that's about Medicare. So
right,
there's changes in the law that extend the life of the program by changing the financing structure, making payments to how we pay for certain things. And so Medicare is a very big piece of the puzzle. And remember that 80% of the people that die in the United States die with a Medicare card in their pocket, or maybe on the nightstand if they're not walking around, which most of them are not. And so we're the insurer that's going to have pretty much everyone in the long run, and that influences how people think about insurance too. A lot of people will hold off on an elective procedure when they're 60, 62, until they have Medicare, and then they can afford it.
So, and you were talking about in the not too distant past, but it is interesting that Medicare currently has the expenses are beginning to fall off a little bit from when I've been able to interview other medical care delivery analysts. So there's some surprises in where that trend is right now. Is there not?
Correct. The program, the growth of Medicare previously, was outstripping the growth in general growth in the economy, and that has stopped. It's almost flat. That doesn't mean it's not growing, but it's not growing ahead of the economy. It looks like it's going to pick up a little bit. We've got more people coming into the program. That's a positive thing. And something that people don't think about, over the last 10, 20 years, the growth in the cost of private health insurance is much greater than the growth in Medicare. And so there are things built into the Medicare program that are, you know, cost savers that we see private insurers often adopt after we implement them. But the government is in a position, being the largest insurer, to, you know, take more effective action, I think, around making decisions, because they're one big relationship that providers have. And in Medicare, the government gets to set the prices, whereas, of course, insurers have to negotiate with those providers.
Well, I think the general public is on that the rate of the private health insurance coverage is increasing at a more rapid rate. So I wanted to take up, though, when you were talking about there are some cost savers that are in being implemented now. Can you unpackage that a little bit more, David?
Well, yeah, I think there's a few things. One is there is something called accountable care. And so in the law, whereas before we had the original fee-for-service Medicare program, that's about 70% of the people. We have the Medicare Advantage program. Those are people that have Medicare but opt to get their benefits from a private company like a United or a Pacificare or a Kaiser. And those were the two flavors. So entirely fee-for-service or entirely a capitated payment to a private company. So they pay, we pay every month for you to go have your care at Kaiser or wherever. Now there's this third stream that the Congress has created called shared savings, where in that fee-for-service program, where it's harder to get a handle on the growth, we've asked groups of physicians, physicians in hospitals, a lot of different structures, and there are several of these in your service area, to make a proposal to us to work together as a group and work toward targets toward improving the quality of the care that they provide to the Medicare beneficiaries they see, and in getting financial incentives if the care they render is more efficient. So for the population of people they see, if the total spending with those constraints about quality, they meet the quality targets and the total spending is less, we share those savings with them. That's a novel idea, and we've already saved a couple of billion dollars doing that. We've got over 200 organizations doing that, and we have a whole bolus of people that want to do it next year. We're reviewing those applications now. So the Congress has, you know, found a way, based on experiments that we've done in the past, to let people have the two things they want. You remember the light beer that was more taste and less filling?
Okay.
People want freedom of choice to go to the doctors that they want, but we also need a more efficient program. And so we found a way to give a little bit of each side of Medicare in this hybrid product, if you will, that looks like it's working pretty well.
So does that have, if you can tell from where you're hovering over all these many policies and programs, does that create incentives for people to address their health issues before they become critical health issues? And
that's exactly what it's about. So
that's incentive built in.
And also in the law, we eliminated out-of-pocket payments for preventive and screening services. That's a big help. I had one of those last week. I'm 60. There's some that you need. And it was very pleasant to not have to bring money to make a payment at the counter. So that's an encouragement. But the other thing is, these organizations, how are they going to reduce the spending of the population that they're serving? If it's a Medicare population, they're going to do it by avoiding unnecessary hospitalizations. That midnight call where you get in the emergency van and they have to take you to the hospital and there goes $30,000 that maybe didn't have to get spent if somebody's constantly talking to the patient with diabetes to make sure that they're managing their blood level, or somebody is reaching out to the patient that has congestive heart failure to make sure that they're using their blood thinners effectively. So what we're doing is seeing these organizations create care teams that support the physician using data about their patients to stratify who are the people that are most at risk for having an event. We don't want people to go to the hospital. It's bad for you to go to a hospital. It's a dangerous place full of sick people. So if we can keep you home and healthy, that's where we want you to be. And that's, I think, a real core of this is working with the patient, the family, the caregivers to help these people maintain that level of functioning that keeps them at home. And by the way, now they're enjoying life and going out with their friends and doing things instead of hanging around a hospital waiting room in the emergency room.
Reducing the comorbidities there. So if you've just joined us, we're talking with David Sein, the Medicare Medicaid Regional Director of, that's Region 9, of the Western States. That includes California, Arizona, Nevada, Hawaii, and the Pacific Territories. We're celebrating, last month was the Medicare Medicaid's 50th anniversary, and you're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, streaming on the web, doctor's offices, and hallways and the healthcare management agencies on the web here at KUCI.org. So the shared savings is how old in the Medicare program?
It's in the Affordable Care Act. That's really just, you know, the act is a few years old, and it's probably been about 3 years since we've been doing these programs, maybe four.
So that's how the Affordable Care Act is interacting with the Medicare program and controlling the health care costs. That's a part of it. Are there other measures that you can think of?
Sure. There are advances in what we call value-based purchasing, where if we think about hospitals, which is the biggest spend in Medicare program, now they face a financial penalty if their readmission rate, the rate at which people that they treated come back for the same problem, either to their hospital or another, they face a penalty if they do that poorly. They are rated on patient satisfaction that we survey. They're rated on quality of care measures, like whether they're doing certain evidence-based things. If they fail to do those things well, they get paid less. If they do them well, they get paid more. Obviously, if they do those things well, there'll be fewer readmissions. There'll be more people having successful outcomes to their work. And there are a number of other programs like that. The Congress has asked us to do that both in the Medicare Modernization Act back in 2003 and then more so in the Affordable Care Act. For every category of provider, now we have these quality programs, and the Secretary wants us to get to 100% of our payments being paid with some quality focus like that, and then we're trying to double the number of payments that we make that are in arrangements like what I described to you as accountable care, and there are other programs like that, one of which is around bundling packages of services and having doctors and hospitals work together to find ways to engineer them more efficiently, like orthopedic events, for example, that can be predicted better, and just a whole host of things. It's been very exciting. You know, I kind of became eligible for retirement around the time that this law passed, but there's no way that I would not, you know, pass up on the opportunity to be part of something that I think is really historic.
Well, that's a beautiful thing, the administrator being a beneficiary. So there's nothing like consuming the goods and services of something you're responsible for. So so you're in the special place. So the financial sustainability of Medicare and Medicaid, there's some rumors of your demise, but can you tell us, so I mean, you've talked a little bit about how with shared savings and these other programs are reducing the funding, but what is the long-term kind of financial fitness for the Medicaid, Medicare programs?
So the Medicare program, like any nonprofit institution or in your community, has a board of trustees. My wife is on the board of trustees of our local county health system, you know, and I really appreciate the importance of those kinds of groups. And so in Medicare, there are a group of trustees, and they're aided and abetted by our independent actuary at CMS, and they are responsible every year to create a 75-year projection for the program. And I don't know of any other government program that projects that far in the future, long after any of us will be walking on the earth.
Wow.
But we do that, and they also make more near-term projections. And so these questions about what Medicare and Medicaid are going to do in the future are not really open to speculation, because there are actuaries and they're experts, and they know how to score these things. And in their most recent report, they see the Medicare Part A trust fund. Those are the dollars that are accumulated from payroll taxes but haven't been used yet for care. They see a positive balance in that fund for the next 15 years. Now, if I see a positive cash flow in my household for the next 15 years, I'm good with that.
Yeah.
You know, you can't plan that much further than 15 years because there's too many things that are going to change. So we're in good shape at present, and that doesn't mean we don't have to redouble our efforts. I mean, maybe we could have a Medicare program where the costs actually go down and make dollars available for other things like, you know, abating pollution or whatever. That would be great, too. So we're on the job with that. And remember that between now and 15 years from now, there will be other Affordable Care Acts and Medicare Modernization Acts, and it will continue to be adjusted as we go forward. So I don't see any need to have someone certify today that this program will last forever, because nothing will last forever. We had a 4.0 earthquake here yesterday morning.
Oops.
I was sitting here working, and it lasted long enough for me to think, gee, what am I supposed to do? Oh, yes, put my clothes on, and by the time I got some clothes on and went outside, because I was in bed, you know, it was over.
It was aftershock.
So, Right. Fortunately, there wasn't an aftershock. Right. So you have to plan for the future, but you can't plan for 75 years from now. I think our trustees, the people at CMS, are doing a responsible job of managing this program, and there's a healthy debate about what changes should be made for the future. That's a great debate. Bring it on.
Well, I think when you're looking at the outcomes of more people covered in the Affordable Care Act, you're going to have a healthier cohort joining on to Medicare, which you must be looking positively toward that, what those 15 years can look like in expenditures.
Well, that's the kind of thing that's tough to score, and it's interesting. I don't know that the actuaries really looked at that, because it takes a little while for something like that to take root. But you're right, that's a very important thing. Health used to be, when the program started, you got sick, you went to the doctor. You got very sick, you went to the hospital. It's not like that now. Now we understand that health is about going to your yoga class. Health is about watching what you eat. Health is about not smoking. That's what health is about. And health plans and medical offices and doctors and care teams can aid people in maintaining and managing their health. And then we can avoid these unnecessary expensive adventures, which, by the way, are not fun.
Right, right. Well, I want, while we still have you on, if you could tell us about the rulemaking that will allow for physicians to bill advanced care planning. And I understand that you're accepting comments until about September 8th, next month. So what can you tell us about how that could change what physicians and patients can do together and to improve the quality of life? And it should have even a savings in some senses.
Well, this is really quite simple. Today, when you become eligible for Medicare, the program will cover a physical exam with a doctor, nurse practitioner, whoever you use, and that can include a discussion about what kinds of things you want to plan for your health at the end of your life, and that practitioner will be reimbursed for that service. What we're adding to that, or what we propose to add, is two more ways to cover that kind of a service. One would be when you're diagnosed with an illness. So, boom, bad news, you've got cancer. So let's talk about what we're going to do about your cancer, and we're going to talk about how you're going to live the rest of your life with this cancer and whether we beat it or we don't. And so at that juncture, if you want to talk to your provider about what you might do if the things don't turn out the way you want or the way it ends up, we pay for that. That's great. Then there's another kind of payment where now you're in the cancer, you're in the heart disease, whatever, and it's really not going well. So now it's a different conversation. It might take a little bit longer. So that'll have a different code. We haven't priced the code yet. So what we're proposing to do, have three different kinds of payment for a practitioner that has a serious conversation with you, your caregiver, your family, about how to manage health resources that can make your life better when you are very sick. And that's when you join Medicare. Most people aren't thinking about it then. When you find out you're sick, and then when you are very sick. That's really all there is to it, and we've published this in a rule. It's easy to find if you go to our website, go right to the newsroom press release. You'll find the press release about it, and people can talk to us about what they like to do. We base this on what the doctors propose. The American Medical Association proposed that we do this, and like I said at the beginning, the doctors are the ones that take care of us when we're ill, and the other practitioners, and what we're here to do in Medicare is to help them succeed at that. We're not here to take care of people. We don't do that. And so what we believe in this rule is those doctors, those nurse practitioners, they should get paid for doing that, and then they'll be more likely to do it, and it'll be good for people to have a plan.
And as you said, I just want to slow down that the feature here is this discussion of advanced directives, it's with a patient, a family member, a surrogate, and so that is really broadening the kind of awareness that a patient and their circle, their team has about what their choices are. The defaults, it's not about a default anymore. It's about looking at broadly at what your choices are, because those defaults weren't necessarily such a rich way to carry on. And so I'm glad to see that. And there's a way to direct people's comments before the comment time closes. One of them is that it's called the CPT billing codes, or you could call it code 99497, 99498 if you want to get really wonky with your public comment. So do they direct it to the Medicare.gov website, David?
The easiest thing I can tell people about this topic is go to www.cms.gov. That's our sort of business website as opposed to patient kind of beneficiary website. And if you click on the newsroom there, you'll see everything we do gets a press release. And that's the easiest way to know what's going on with the Medicare program. And if you'll see the one for this, it comes up right away. And then within there, you can both read the rule, you can read a fact sheet about the rule, and you can see where you send comments to the government about that.
All right. On that note, I want to thank you, David, for your time. It's a pleasure having you on today.
I can't wait to do it again.
Okay, well, that's good because I think we will do it again. So that's David Cyan is a Region 9 Administrator for the Medicare and Medicaid Regional Programs. That's Western USA. We'll be right back after a short station break with our co-founders of Pro Alliance for Children, a group of volunteer professionals that are going to help that are helping now families with urgent health care needs. Be right back after a short station break. What's new? How is the world treating you? I hope it's treating you well enough. We're trying to check in with some people that are making sure the world treats it. All of us a bit better. Welcome back to Ask a Leader. My next guests are Jim Dell and John Byer, co-founders of Pro Alliance for Children, a group of volunteer professionals offering families free legal and financial advice on matters related to their children's care. A little bit about these gentlemen. Jim Dell is both an attorney for the Alliance and the executive director of the Alliance. He completed his Bachelor of Arts and the ROTC program at the University of Illinois. He then went on to serve in the Navy and was a veteran of Gulf War I and Operation Southern Watch. After his service, Jim completed his law degree at the University School of Law. As an attorney, Jim has practiced in the areas of elder, aviation, estate, planning business, and public interest law. Jim eventually opened his own practice with his wife in Indianapolis. In addition to practicing law, Jim has been a flight instructor, vice president of the Air Charter Company, and an air pilot. He has served on several nonprofit boards, has been lauded for his pro bono legal services to the poor. John Byer is a financial advisor and certified financial planner professional. He is a partner and vice president of wealth management with Blankenship and Foster, Limited Liability Corporation, I think LLC stands for. Previously, John worked with an accounting and consulting firm in San Diego. While there, he provided comprehensive financial planning and investment portfolio management advice to high net worth individuals and business owners. He is active in community outreach and pro bono financial advice efforts and has reaped some pretty high yields in helping families succeed in managing their own finances. He's earned his Bachelor of Science degree in Finance from San Diego State University and his Master of Science degree in Financial and Tax Planning from San Diego State University. It's a pleasure to bring them on today and honor the tall order they've taken on with Pro Alliance for Children. Welcome to Ask a Leader, Jim Dell and John Byer.
Thanks, Claudia.
Well, thank you, Claudia.
Well, I want to find out how and what got you started in this niche enterprise, providing what is essentially a safety net of sorts for some children in need.
Well, Claudia, Jim and I have done a lot of work together to try and serve the public in underserved areas, and so we were familiar with working together on pro bono efforts. But in 2007, following the birth of my daughter, I was directly exposed to what some families go through with a health crisis with their child. My own child had a severe health crisis, was in danger of losing her life, and we went through what a lot of families are going through in an immediate shift in all of our priorities. Number one priority for us was getting our daughter back to health, and everything else kind of took a back seat, and saw how many families are in that same boat and all the disruptions to their life it caused. And when Jim and I started talking about that underserved market, we realized how underserved it is and how many people really need help and that there's no outlet for them to get that help, especially when they can't afford it.
I guess there is nothing that teaches us like the difficulties of navigating many institutions and wondering, wow, if I consider myself a reasonably sophisticated consumer, what is somebody outside of my level of training, outside of my cultural frame of reference, how are they going to deal with it? I really get how clear that message was, and that you just, and it's really phenomenal that you decided to take it up like that. Well, let's talk about your demographics. When we were preparing for this interview, you were saying that there's other funded programs for veterans, for abused spouses, for elders, but not for children. It's a bit surprising. This constituency is overlooked, isn't it?
Well, yes.
Claudia, and
yes.
That's why John and I kind of looked around when we were at a conference at Rady Children's Hospital of what are the attorneys in San Diego doing for a seriously ill child? What are the financial professionals doing for seriously ill children? And we didn't come up with a whole lot. So surprisingly, it is a rather underserved community. And what we find, it's so rewarding to work with the children, because obviously when you help a child, you may get 100 years of good from that over their lifespan. But we are surprised when we looked around that they don't have a lot of programs where attorneys are helping seriously ill or families who have a seriously ill child to get the benefits, say, with health care, insurance, or public benefits that help them survive a very serious stress on the family when you have a seriously ill child like John expressed when his daughter got ill.
So why you deal with such an extensive array of, it's daunting, an array of institutions and bureaucracies. Tell us about what public benefits entails for your target population, children in need, with urgent health problems?
Well, the first thing we look for is make sure that the child has health care. And a lot of times, you know, a family who does have a seriously ill child hasn't had time to build wealth. So a lot of times we're looking at Medi-Cal, which is the fallback health insurance for children, or potentially California Children's Services, which is a program that we really appreciate, because that will even cover children who are not eligible for Medi-Cal due to their non-status as U.S. citizens or legal permanent residents. So that picks up and helps some of the children. Then second of all, we look at how do we reduce the stress down on the families, and that's oftentimes a financial issue, because if you have a seriously ill child, oftentimes at least one parent or both can't continue to work because they're at the hospital maybe 7 days a week, you know, at times, or a leukemia treatments last for approximately 5 years. So they lose the ability to bring an income to the family. So that's why we look at the financial side second. And then we've got programs such as SSI, which is Supplemental Security Income, which brings in cash aid to the family. CalWORKS is another program we look at. CalFresh. In-home supportive services, which is one of our favorite programs, because that actually provides a job for a spouse who can't work because of they need to take care of their child. And that really helps to reduce the stress down in the family. But, you know, your question is a good one, because this just shows how complicated the system is for, you know, family to understand or try to get the help that they need to get the stress down.
And the beauty of your contribution is you know what the public benefits are, and you are aware and experiencing how in these cases that you take on, there are denials for otherwise eligible individuals for a given program. And there you are on the scene working, unraveling that denial in your appeals. And maybe you could tell us a bit how that works, how you can see it, and maybe a couple of case studies, in fact, to make the point.
Yeah, one area we see that families are often denied benefits is IHSS. That's the one that I just referred to, in-home supportive services that provides an income to a parent who can't work outside of the home because they need to take care of their seriously ill child. Oftentimes, we're finding that the children are denied this benefit due to age, for instance, where the county will argue that the child is not eligible for this services because they're young and you'd have to take care of them anyway. That's not what the law says. The law says it's based on the disability of the child. So the families are so stressed, and then they go to apply for this benefit, if they even know to apply for this benefit, and they get denied, and they don't know how to take something on appeal, and they assume that the county is correct in denying them this benefit. So, for example, we had one case where we had a young child who has a chronic lung disease who's on oxygen for 24 hours a day, requires extensive care, and the father, a single parent, couldn't work because he had to take care and make sure the child was receiving oxygen and also a subcutaneous pump for medicines, a very serious case. So he was denied IHSS based on age because it was a five-year-old, and the county argued you'd have to take care of this child anyway. But that's not what the law is designed to do. It's basically to keep this child from being institutionalized by providing a little support to the parent to take care of the child at home. Well, they lost on appeal. They came to us. We won on appeal, got a $20,000 retroactive award for the parent, and then ongoing it will be about $30,000 a year payment to the parent so he can stay at home and properly take care of the child.
Essentially,
that's
making
just
him
one of the many examples.
Right, yeah. Right, right. No, I'm saying so. You're making you're giving economic value in a sense to that caregiver for maintaining their child's best possible health given the situation.
Oh, sure, and it's definitely best for society to do this. Unfortunately, IHSS is a minimum wage job, but it's certainly best for society to help this father stay at home and properly take care of his child. Otherwise, the family is going to fall apart, essentially, and we see families facing eviction because they're not getting any support or they're not getting the benefits that they deserve. And we've seen children, unfortunately, taken away by the state because the parent just collapses out of depression, economic hardship, and then the child's turned over into the foster care system with very expensive care. So it's best for society to go ahead and take care of these parents, but providing the support that they need.
For those of you who've just joined us, my guests are Jim Dell, whose voice you just heard, and John Byer, co-founders of Pro Alliance for Children, a nonprofit based in San Diego that attends to urgent needs of children. They are a nonprofit comprised of financial planners and attorneys, all working pro bono. You're listening to this program at Ask a Leader on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, streaming around the world on the web at KUCI.org. Now, that was one instance. I'd like to know, Jan, do you have some other case studies that can help illustrate and help us really fire up in our memories so we understand what you've been able to do in these five short years?
Right. Well, Claudia, you know, as Jim was talking about, the crisis with a child's serious illness really can be a huge stress on a family, and it affects them in a lot of ways. It affects their ability to keep working in their normal job or business. It affects their time. Their time priorities get shifted, especially when they have urgent surgeries, treatments, things like that that the child has to be attending to. And it affects them emotionally, and it affects their decision-making. And so in where we see things really start to fall apart is families that live in Southern California, as you know, pay a high price for housing, and just living expenses in general are very high. And when things are going along as normal, they're working and getting an income and all that, it works. But when you have a disruption like this, things get turned on their head, and families fall into financial distress.
It's a
spiraling.
And
so a recent case that we helped a family with directly illustrated this. You know, they live in a house in San Diego County. It's quite expensive to rent or own there. And when this crisis came up, the two-income household all of a sudden became a one-income household. And so the family immediately started to tack on debt and started to fall behind on various payments. And as it got worse, they were unable to pay the rent on their house. And so where we stepped in was to help them straighten that situation out and to get into a more sustainable situation for them. And so there's a lot that went into that. There's the public benefits side of it where we help them get qualified for benefits that could help them. But it also is the economic decision-making that we had to help them with and the credit and debtor issues.
So what, do they have to relocate to in one way to sort of refinance their family budget?
Ultimately, they did. Yeah, that's ultimately what had to happen. And what we often see is that a family will have to come to a new immediate situation that can work for them to get through this crisis, and
yes,
then they can work on getting back to a normal situation for the long term. But sometimes it takes years for that to happen.
Okay. So you're constantly on the lookout for volunteers to join your fold. What type of student, what type of professional is Pro-Alliance for Children looking for?
Well, I think we're looking for anyone who wants to help better the lives of seriously ill children. But specifically, we really need attorneys who understand disability law, public benefits law. And that's where we really think the community can improve, the legal community, and even the financial professionals. Most of the financial professionals work with people who have a lot of money. Well, we're working with families who are very poor and very struggling just to make their house payments on their apartment. So, you know, where there is money, there are people who help because they get paid to do that. What we're trying to find is people who are successful already, who are established in their practices, but have some time and want to give back to the community by serving the seriously ill children where there isn't an economic award, but there certainly is a huge reward in seeing, you know, a child's life get better, you know, through this crisis. Really specifically, though, we're looking for attorneys who understand disability law, because right now we're finding there aren't a lot of attorneys that will go out and help children who are denied SSI, Supplemental Security Income, because the federal government says, oh, you're not disabled. There's a fine line a lot of times on whether someone's disabled or not, especially when it comes to children. We're also looking for financial professionals who want to understand people who don't have a lot of money, because it's a little bit different area to work in. And we have a training program that we run once a year that tries to help these professionals learn to help seriously ill children.
And just, I'd like to find out, when does that occur again, that training program?
This year will be in November on a weekend. Let me pull up my calendar.
While you're looking up, then we can get back to that. So I was curious, too, if the Bar Association has a kind of a pro bono aspect to attorneys practicing anywhere in the country, is there a financial planner kind of pro bono charter that cycles in your peers into providing these services to low-income household units?
Well, there is, Claudia. Actually, there's two in Southern California that are active. One of them is the Financial Planning Association, which is a national and actually international organization of financial planners, most of them certified financial planners. They have a very robust pro bono area and lots of different practitioners across the country doing pro bono work. There's also the National Association of Personal Financial Advisors, or NAPFA, which is another industry organization for financial planners, and they also do a lot of pro bono work. So there's great people in the financial planning field that want to help people on a strictly altruistic basis, not for their own economic gain, but really just to help.
And I find it's classic in these kinds of contributions that a professional makes. Sometimes it's kind of hard to say who's benefiting more in the interplay, whether it's the pro bono professional or the beneficiary of that service. Is that, I mean, you two could talk just briefly to that kind of experience that you get that's so fulfilling.
Well, and just when we talk about, you know, the benefit that one can get, we have a strict code of conduct and agreement with anybody that volunteers with us that they won't try to benefit economically from working with the family. In most cases, there's really not an opportunity to anyway,
no, right.
But that they're very clear when we work with them that it's not for self-promotion, not for self-gain. This is strictly for helping people. And you know, people get that. So we haven't come into, you know, problems of people trying to abuse the pro bono work. But that said, there's so many benefits to helping families in this way. It's helpful at a soul level and a heart level. And I've found it tremendously enriching in my life, and a lot of the other volunteers have said the same.
And Jim and Jan, you both...
I agree with Jan.
Yes. Okay, great. Well, you've both...
I agree with John, and I think that hopefully both benefit from this. Obviously, we wouldn't volunteer to do this if we didn't great benefit, but we certainly would benefit as well, or it just wouldn't be worth doing.
And both of you, you're involved in something of developing a template. You wouldn't mind one bit if this was to be copied and brought to a charitable franchise model to other, but everybody could put their name of town in that location where they could implement this kind of a thing. So the Pro Alliance for Children is there for a model for starting this kind of enterprise in other places.
Yeah, that's right. And I've got the answer to your question on our training day is November 14th. It'll probably be at the Ronald McDonald House here in San Diego. But if we get enough people to attend, we'll move it to one of the law schools. But I think you're on the right track where it's funny you mentioned a charitable franchise, because we started out hoping that people around the country would copy our program to help even more seriously ill children. That hasn't happened yet because we've been so busy working in San Diego and Imperial counties, and no one or very few people have contacted us. But we want people to copy exactly what we're doing, so people outside of San Diego County, maybe up in Orange County, L.A., San Francisco would be the first places to do this as well, because we're, again, not seeing enough programs for the seriously ill children. Sometimes they're kind of run under the radar unless you have a seriously ill child in your
right.
family or know another family in your neighborhood.
So eligibility for signing up for this training program, is it open to anybody?
Yeah, and our website is proalliance.org, spelled proalliance.org. And if you go on there, we'll have a link to sign up for this training. Or if anyone who's listening wants to volunteer and know more about us, you know, please call me at 858-349-4481.
All right. I'll put that in the summary. And there's also a Facebook page that you have, so that may be posting what's coming up. You can see who else is joining on there. But I just want to close with this last question, if you can address this somewhat quickly. Have you been able to gauge improvements as to how these federal, these state, and local institutions are performing based on your interactions with them? That after so many appeals, they realize, oh, we know that it's not a matter of denial by age, but it is a matter of eligibility because of a disability. Are you seeing improvements with these institutions?
Well, I hope so, but right now we're taking one case at a time, and we want to become more efficient by doing what's called a writ, which if we see continuing problems with, like, the IHSS program that you mentioned, where they're being denied on age and they're not taking into account their disability, it would be best if we can fix the system. So we're working and talking with the county, first of all, to see if we can do it by just talking with the county officials to try to get the correction in. But second of all, if that doesn't work, then we've got to go through the legal system in a class action type of case in order to get this fixed. So, because I really believe that probably hundreds, if not thousands, of children have been improperly denied this benefit just based on age and not taking account their disability.
Well, that speaks volumes about what's been happening and the amazing breakthroughs you're making. And I certainly hope that, we can get an update on that. And I imagine you're very young now. It's only 5 years, but I'm just looking forward to covering where you have dividend. You can realize where you see where a beneficiary of your program has made good, maybe returned the favor, but has become a very fulfilled and productive individual society that's made every bit of the investment you've made, and the institutions within the provision of the public benefits that this person has prospered. Well, I want to thank both Jim Dell and Jan Beyer, for the co-founders of Pro Alliance for Children. I want to thank you both for being on the show today.
Well, thank you, Claudia. We're very glad to be on the show.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Nice talking with you.
All right. And we'll post all of these bits of information so people know how to get a hold of you and the November 14 workshop as well. Good luck on that and with the next case studies that you're taking on.
Thanks.
Well, you are so welcome. Well, next week we're going to look back to the future with all aspects, I hope, of Orange County bicycle planning. Talk with you next week. Thank you for listening.